AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 244 for May 30th. Toyota throws out the plain vanilla approach. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you, John?
I'm just frazzled because I was on the other side of town and had to fight my way through traffic to get here.
So. See, so this indicates the economy's back. People are on the roads. They're going home from work.
I'm telling you, I almost pine for the Great Recession when traffic jams were a thing of the past.
Bite your tongue.
I know. I'm saying that facetiously.
Yes.
And we got Christy Schweinsberg from Ward's with us tonight, too.
John.
Good seeing you.
Good seeing you. Thanks for having me.
So I've been dying to ask you. You've already driven the i8 BMW.
I did. I drove it 3 weeks ago. I was on the one of the international waves, and the particular wave I was on also went to Moses Lake, Washington, where the carbon fiber venture is.
Yeah.
Right. So it was different than your typical Rhine drive, but the car is stunning, beautiful,
gorgeous.
I came away a little bit disappointed,
mm-hmm.
because I'm a Volt owner, and with my Volt, I get at this time of year about 45 miles of range, and this car had 13 in similar type weather. So,
I had no idea. I mean, that's kind of like plug-in hybrid kind of range that you'd get in a Prius.
Right, right. So, for $136,000. And, they've made such a big deal about how green this car is, but to me it all comes down to fuel economy and the electric range, and, I didn't find it terribly impressive. But it drove, it's a sports car. It drove wonderfully.
But, and here's what I've been dying to ask you about,
right.
Getting in and out of the car.
It's tricky. Really, really tricky.
So it's very, very low.
It's very low. The seat is lower than the sill. So you sit on the sill.
The door sill.
Yes, and then you slide back into your seat, which isn't too terrible, but then
getting out
is the real pain because you have to, throw a leg over the sill and then throw other leg over the sill and then do that. And so it's...
I.e. push yourself out of the seat onto the sill.
Right.
This car is sales-proof. I'm telling you, this car is dead in the water.
So, Christy, if you were 40 years older, could you get in or out of that car?
It'd be awfully... You didn't turn off your phone?
All right.
It'd be awfully difficult. And their target audience is 40 to 50-somethings.
So no way.
I think it's going to be a little...
And as a woman in a skirt or an evening gown, are you going to be up to doing that?
I don't think you'd attempt it. Unfortunately, I was worried.
When I read that in your article, I went... What are they thinking? This car has no hope.
Yeah.
A few thousand here and there, just because it's so drop-dead gorgeous.
I mean, it's for sure going to be a niche product. I mean, even if it weren't as eco-friendly as it is, it'd still be a niche product. But kudos to them for trying to redefine performance. I thought about driving the Honda CR-Z 5 years ago, and my conclusion back then was the same as it is now, which is that green performance car is an oxymoron. You really can't have both. So,
I don't know. Porsche might convince us otherwise.
Yeah, I think I'm sure this was before Christie's time, but you and I both drove the EV1. That was a good, fun car to drive.
It was a terrific little car.
The ride
with lead-acid batteries,
right? And it was so it was a clean green car that performed above its class. Let's just put it that way. I mean, it was not in the category of an i8.
Yeah, I don't want to give people the notion that green cars can't be fun to drive, but it's just this 100,000 plus category of car. I think
in dollars,
yes,
price.
Yes, I think people expect.
Is it going to hurt the Tesla Model S at all?
Oh, well, at the Rhine Drive, it was mostly German staff there, and they were all very quick to quell any talk that the Tesla Model S is a competitor. But of course, when you look in that category,
yeah, kind of price wise, you know.
Well, but I mean, if you look at the Model S, I mean, you've got a back seat. This car doesn't have a back seat.
Right.
I mean, so you've got more utility.
You can get in and out of the S very easily.
This is a hybrid. That's a pure EV. I mean, so there are significant differences between the two vehicles. So I think the comparison, if you were to go back to the Tesla Roadster. Okay, mm-hmm. which is based on the Lotus Elise, right. and as you recall, the Lotus Elise is probably even more difficult to get in and out of
than that thing is because of the high sill, low seat.
I just want to note I was masochistic enough to climb in the back seat, and that was that's even harder because you can't get the seatbelt out of your way. So my foot kept getting caught in the seatbelt, and it's really not meant to be used. There's no headrest or head restraint. And the seat is pitched forward like this. And in order to get your legs to fit, you'd have to have the driver right into the steering wheel. So it's...
So in other words, this is a back seat for insurance purposes.
I think so. Yeah.
I.e., if you have a back seat, the insurance companies say, oh, it's not a two-seater, so you get a little bit of a break. But nobody will ever sit back there.
I think the insurance companies are probably onto that scheme.
and I suspect that if you're going to put down the dough to buy one of these cars, that, you know, your insurance premium is really...
You don't care about that.
You know, and plus you're saving all that money on gasoline, right? Just paying for itself.
That's right. So, yeah, very interesting article that you had in Ward's.
Thank you.
And then talk about another new car, bombshell. What do you guys make of the Google car, this little prototype?
This is extraordinary. So I think we ought to explain for those who are not familiar with this is that Google came out this week with a self-driving car. Okay, no steering wheel, no pedals, two buttons, start, stop. You sit in this thing. And it's a little pod thing, and it's very funny. The guy who's in charge of the program said the look is googly, so it's sort of a silly-looking thing because they want people to find it to be very non-threatening in any way, and they let people drive it or be driven by it. I guess you're not even driving the car.
That's right.
I mean, it just changes the whole paradigm of what's
happening. Well, to me, this was the bombshell because, you know, we've been speculating on the show for several years now. What is Google going to do with its autonomous technology? Is it going to license it to other car companies? There was some speculation, would it buy Tesla so it could do autonomous Teslas? And so to see Google, and look, this is a top speed of 25 miles an hour. It's a two-seater. Nonetheless, for Google to put that out there and say, oh, yeah, by the way, we did this car, I think is a bombshell that every automaker in the world should go, whoa-oh, what if they get into the business?
And they're talking about making 100 prototypes of this car, so that's going to be the beginning, and they're going to be testing it out in real-world situations, and they're going to, you know, the plan is to have non-Google employees be able to drive it. I mean, so if out in... Santa Clara County, where Google has the Googleplex, their headquarters, they have a large campus area. And as it is now, and we were on a drive program together there. The most notable thing about the Googleplex is that there are bicycles everywhere. And these are Google bikes. And so people just get on the bike and ride it and leave it. And then when they're going back to their office or wherever, they get on the bike and ride it. And so it's a big area there. And so presumably, you know, the Google car could be driving around those roads. And but they're talking about even going further than that. But it's very interesting that there's a lab called the Google X Lab. And this is where this work is done. So that's where the Google car came from. That's where Google Glass came from. Hmm. And so the guy who runs this place, his name is Astro Teller, and
I'll bet his mom didn't give him that name.
And their goal is to improve technologies by a factor of 10 and to develop, and I quote, science fiction sounding solutions. So, I mean, this sounds completely bizarre that, you know, you'd have this car that you'd get in and, you know, push the button. Mm-hmm. and uh, it would take you where you want to go. But, you know, they're looking at it not necessarily for, you know, any one of us owning it, but taxicab fleets. Mm-hmm. So if you're living in San Francisco or whatever and you need a cab, one of these things could drive up and you'd get in it and take you where you need to go.
Hey, that's this whole new business that everyone's talking about, mobility services.
Sure.
Where you no longer buy or lease a car, you buy your mobility service, i.e. you hit the app on your phone and the Google car comes and gets you.
Right.
But taxi drivers will be obsolete.
Well, but then if you look at it, I mean, Lyft and Uber, these services whereby, you know, we could join up and drive people in our cars instead of getting taxi cabs. I mean, that's beginning to displace some of that as it is.
That's true.
So, you know, you're beginning to see, and, you know, and that's all enabled by technology because you're able to have an app on your phone, a Lyft app or an Uber app, mm-hmm. and that's how you get it, and that's how you pay for it. I mean, you're not giving the guy any money. You're basically paying through your phone. So, you know, you begin to go down this road. And it's sort of interesting if you think about it that Google has been, you know, spending a number of years, you know, developing this technology and, you know, had a fleet of Lexus RXs that they were, you know.
And Priuses.
That they were instrumenting, right, with this stuff. And, you know, they discovered that in order to have sensors that would have even better sensibility, that they needed to have a new car design. So they would have more access than with an existing product. So this gets to your point of, you know, does Google get into the car business
right.
as a car manufacturer?
Right. And they got the cash to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And no, I find it's interesting. And in fact, you just mentioned Uber. The news broke today that, you know, they're going to be doing an IPO. That's not the news that broke. The news that broke is their IPO may value the company at $10 billion, and some are saying $17 billion for a chauffeur service, essentially.
See, and you thought Tesla was overvalued.
Yes, I did, and do. I think the market will take care of Tesla in that regard. Hey, another thing that came out this week, I was interested to get your guys' reaction, is the Union of Concerned Scientists came out and anointed Hyundai Kia as the greenest car going. And while I think very highly of Hyundai and Kia, you know, it seemed to me like an unfair comparison.
I can't say I read up on the study, but you're concerned with their methodologies?
Well, it's not so much the methodology is that, you know, Honda was in second place.
Right.
They don't make full-size pickups. They don't make full-size SUVs. They barely make full-size cars. Hyundai does, certainly. But so to average all that in,
right,
to me is like, wouldn't it be better to do who's the best at compact cars? Who's mm-hmm. the best at full-size trucks? Who's the best at fill in the blank?
Well, John, as you know me, I read all the minutiae.
Yes, you do.
And lo and behold, in the report, they'd break it down that way. So if they have small cars, mid-sized cars, large cars, sports cars, SUVs, minivans, pickup trucks, and they rate Hyundai, Honda, Toyota, Nissan, Volkswagen, Ford, GM, and Chrysler. So they're factoring all that in. What the more interesting thing about the study was, you know, and we talked about it at the show at the time it was happening, was the bad numbers that Hyundai had in terms of miles per gallon.
Yes, did they use the new numbers?
Well, and they have this whole appendix on adjustment to fuel economy labels for model year 2013 and talking about, you know, what they did. You know, for our first alternative analysis, we adjusted fuel economy the entire Hyundai fleet downward, you know, because of the automaker's test protocol, it could have affected all vehicles, you know, and so, I mean, they really gave these guys a harder time.
Do they sales weight these vehicles?
I believe.
You know, because Honda's been famous in the past for coming out with an FX Civic that gets super high fuel economy that you couldn't.
Well, yeah, they sort of do because basically so they've been running this study since the year 2000. So they've done six of these, and every other year Honda has been the greenest car maker.
Right.
Okay, and what they really knock Honda on is the fact that the Accord is not as green as other mid-sized cars in the category. So yes, they are looking at sales weighting in that regard. So that is a thing.
Okay, good.
And you know, and although the big three are at the bottom. The laudatory comments about how well Ford is doing and all of the technology that Ford is applying, and you know, Ford is improving the fastest by selling more hybrids and by using turbochargers to power smaller, more efficient engines without reducing performance. I mean, they Ford ought to be touting this to the high hills. I mean, they really give them a big boost. So I don't find that to be too bad.
So why is the Accord not as green as competitors? What are they basing that on?
Well, they're just saying if you look at the miles per gallon and the tailpipe emissions of other vehicles in the class.
My guess is
Honda probably sells a lot more V6s.
They do.
Certainly, right. You can't even get one in the
right.
Sonata.
Right. And, you know, and then speaking of the Accord, I mean, and you talked about it today, was the Accord Hybrid not getting the stated window sticker numbers according to Consumer Reports.
Right.
And so Consumer Reports basically said, you know, it's still the only hybrid that they've driven of the size that got more than 40 miles per gallon. But they think if you buy the Accord with the four-cylinder and CVT package, you're getting 4 miles per gallon and you're saving a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, and that Accord Hybrid's a very interesting hybrid. It's unlike any other. It's both a series and a parallel hybrid, depending on the mode it's operating in.
Yeah.
And so technically, I was very impressed by it. So it's kind of surprising to see it doesn't really deliver the real world numbers.
Yeah, it didn't for me either. Like, everybody's gaga about this car. And when I had it for a weekend last fall, and I only got like 38 or 39. So it was well off the stated number for me as well. But then again, you know, the hybrid tests are not what they should be, right? That was what Jake Fisher said.
I got better than 82 in it.
In the Honda Accord Hybrid?
In a test, yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to repeat it.
It's not real world.
It was real world.
My
hazards are never on. I was in San Antonio. I was on real streets. The only thing that I didn't do, it was like 95 degrees outside. I didn't turn the air conditioner on. But the windows were down, so that's it. And,
yeah,
and
all that aerodynamic.
And I've driven with Christy on when we drove the Prius, the current generation together,
right.
and we were trying to do, you know, trying to get miles per gallon. Hazard lights, side of the road.
Well, that's what everybody else was doing. And
look, I've seen hypermilers do some of the most stupid things. I've seen people open the driver's door while making a left-hand turn so that the car didn't lean as much going through the turn. And I thought, you're losing it all in aero anyway. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, that's very interesting about the Accord Hybrid, because, of course, Ford was nailed on this very same thing, what was that, a year or two ago?
Yeah. I mean, it's still a great car, but, again, it's another green car that doesn't deliver perhaps what you expect it to deliver.
And then another topic I had to get on to, I did this on Tuesday, I just vented about TV coverage of motor racing, because I had watched the Monaco Grand Prix, I'd watched the Indy 500, and I watched the NASCAR 600. The Monaco F1 race, the coverage is not bad.
Okay, but you watched it on CBC rather than NBC, or watched it on NBC?
NBC.
You watched it on NBC.
I can't get CBC.
Oh, because
Channel 9, CBC Windsor, does not run the F1 coverage that most of the rest of Canada gets. I would love to watch the BBC.
Because it was Sunday morning and Coronation Street was on. You can't mess with Coronation Street, so that's probably why they didn't have
it. I only know
that
show by title. I've never watched it.
So it's a British soap opera, so
okay.
That's been running for, I don't know,
50, 60 years.
Yeah, and,
something like
so,
that.
So anyway, be that as it may. Okay, so I watched the Monaco race, and... Okay, it just seems to me, so you're not a fan of Darrell Waltrip in Boogity Boogity Boogity.
No, I think Boogity has got to go.
And so it just seems to me that basically the Brits, okay, so NBC has two Brits and an American, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
And basically those Brits.
No, they're all three. There's three Brits now.
Are they three Brits now?
Yeah.
Be that as it may, it's like three Brits, two of whom are saying boogity, 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 but they say it in the British accent. It sounds so much more sophisticated. It's like, wow, that's insightful.
No, it's they'll call the race as it's happening. So, like, in the IndyCar race, they get the green flag, and these guys don't say anything. For the first lap, they don't say a thing. In the F1 coverage, they're telling you throughout the field, not every single car, mind you, but they're telling you what's happening as you watch it. Because these guys are trained. I mean, they follow every race. They do every practice. They do every qualifying. They know which car is what and who's the driver.
Right.
So they're calling. Boom, you know, this is what's going. And in the IndyCar stuff, you don't get nothing. The NASCAR stuff, you don't get nothing. Ryan Hunter Ray is the leader now. I mean, it's... And they get into all these backstories and yak and yak, and instead of analyze what's going on with the race right now, I think there's no question whatsoever why they're losing TV audience for these motor races is because the coverage sucks. It's really bad.
I'm going to make a lot of enemies, but racing on TV is boring as hell, and I don't watch it, and I think a lot of people feel that way. I mean, what's so exciting about cars going around a track? You know, it's...
Yeah. All right, so John, but I checked the Nielsen ratings.
Yeah.
The Coca-Cola 600 kicked ass.
Did it really?
Compared to what I should say is
boogity boogity boogity.
So in its viewership or its share of the valuable 18 to 49 demographic was just kicking butt over America's Funniest Home Videos on ABC.
Yeah, which is probably the 100th rerun of that anyway.
60 Minutes on CBS and American Dream Builders, whatever that is, on NBC. So actually, it worked out pretty well. But yes, historically, the numbers going down. And the IndyCar numbers were actually better than they were last year. So who knew? But they're still pathetic. But I mean, I think that this evinces a larger cultural thing. I mean, not only are there the Christies of the world who are going to say, you know, it just sucks, you don't want to watch it on TV. But you know, this gets back to this question of car culture in general that we've talked about. I mean, do people really care that much about motor racing or even car ownership?
I'll stick with the car racing for a moment. If you talk about what's going on in the race as it's taking place, you can make that coverage far more interesting than what they do right now. Far more interesting.
But I don't golf, okay? I have zero interest in golf.
Yeah.
And sometimes when I'm at my brother-in-law's house and he golfs, he'll have golf on, and these guys are yakking all the time about who's doing what and what he's doing.
But
they're giving all the details, so they're breaking it down just the way you're suggesting they had to break down the races. I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't know what they could do.
Well, you know, different people like different sports. That's
right.
Fine. But what I'm complaining is, as a hardcore motor racing fanatic, everything gets dumbed down. I don't see any other sport get dumbed down like that. They don't, in American football coverage, say, well, you know, they just scored a touchdown, and now they're going to line up and kick an extra point. But that's only one point that they get because, unlike blah, blah, they don't do that. In motor racing coverage, they explain all the stupid things every single race.
Yeah, well, football's on TV every week, you know, on primetime TV. Motor racing isn't. So they've got to refresh people's memories.
There's what, 18 games per team per season? There's how many NASCAR races and Formula One and Indy and drag race. I mean, there's lots of racing on. It's on all the time.
Yeah.
So, what I'm objecting to is the way they dumb it down and the way that they break for commercials. In every other sport, they wait for a break in the action, then they break for commercial. Not in motor racing. Motor racing is the only sport at all that they interrupt the race to show you commercials. So...
It's all about the money, John.
I know.
About the money.
I know. And speaking of all about the money, we should take a commercial break ourselves.
Right.
And then we'll get Monty Carr in here, and we'll talk Kara in here, and we'll talk all about cars. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our excellent, superb friends at Firestone.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there, running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, Drive a Firestone.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go. Well, Monty Kerr, thanks so much for joining us on Autoline After Hours.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's cool to have you. So explain what your position with the Camry is exactly.
I'm chief engineer for North American Camry, in charge of lifecycle management, which involved the big miner that we just came out with.
The big miner, explain that. It sounds like some sort of baseball documentary.
So it's the new Camry.
But a major refresh.
It is. We really redid all of the exterior, everything but the roof. And we not only did a styling redo, not only a skin change, but we also changed substantial interior and chassis components to make it much more fun to drive and a little more athletic.
So why is this considered just to be a refresh and not a new car?
Yeah.
Well, that's a tough question. You can call it anything you want.
That's a tough question here.
You could call it anything you want to, I think. And we're certainly calling it the new Camry.
So it is, I mean, because generally when there's a refresh of a car, the front fascias change, the rear fascias change, they have some new materials on the interior of the car, but basically it sort of looks like the last one.
That's right.
That was just moved off the dealer's lot.
Yep.
This thing is going to look entirely different.
That's right.
And how many years in is this?
This will be 3 years in. The only reason to call it that is the timing sequence. Certainly from every other standpoint, it's a new car.
Now, typically, automakers leave a car out for 4 years. Some longer, usually the expensive ones might go a little longer. 3 years. This has got to be because of the criticism that the car got when it came out.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, when we launched, we continued on with our sales leadership, as we have for 12 years in a row. We did go and listen to customers, wanted to hear what they thought about it. And while they loved the car overall, we did hear some people, a lot of loyal customers, telling us that they wish it had a little more style. So we took that cue and began looking at what we could do with it. Gave it to our guys at Calte here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And they showed us some things we could do with the hard points that we have that we thought were really going to surprise people when it came out.
So explain what you mean by that for people who are not familiar with hard points.
Yeah. So, there are certain features like the engine that you can't violate unless you're going to make a new one. And considering those, we said, what can we do?
So you have dimensions that are fixed. That would be a hard point in that area.
Yes, assuming you're going to keep your current engine. What can you do with the styling? So one of the secrets was we pushed out the front 35 millimeters, the rear 10, and then we did some things like changing to LED headlamps that allowed us to bring those in. So we improved the swept plan view, enabling a much more athletic styling that we have now.
Now, is that true LED lamps or LED surrounds of a projector?
These are going to be true LED lamps,
replacing
HIDs for the high grades. And the HIDs were a key hard point in the previous model. That stack up to the engine was keeping us from bringing the corners in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very interesting.
There were different types of hard points in the interior in terms of the materials were hard, and you've softened up some of that. Well, I'm not saying anything nobody done.
Hard points.
Yeah. So talk about some of the changes to the interior.
Yeah, absolutely. With the exterior change, we wanted to make sure that we also made the interior feel new and different, mm-hmm. and took the opportunity to expand the use of softer materials and more premium materials.
Right.
We've added satin chrome, I think, that really dresses it up on the inside.
And I remember the center stack had sort of a simulated stitching, like at the bottom.
Right.
Is that still there, or has that been changed?
That's gone.
Great.
Yeah, we have all real stitching on the interior, on the IP, on the seats, on the door panels.
So did you guys go out and benchmark what was offered in the midsize category and say, hey, these guys are offering this, and these guys have this, and we've got this, and therefore we need to make modifications in order to be relevant and competitive. You guys are already competitive, as you said. You're still the number one selling car. And
it was really more about what we could do to satisfy our customers and be the best sedan in the segment. I think what we're doing on the interior is different than our competitors. I think it's going to be something that's very pleasing to our customers.
So how long have you been with Toyota?
Since 92.
Since 92.
Wow.
That's a long time.
And so presumably you've seen lots of changes. You were telling me earlier that you started out and you were working in Japan.
Yes, I started right in Japan out of college after doing some co-op work here with BorgWarner Automotive. And it was a shock. The biggest shock to me fitting into that environment as a design engineer was the attention to detail. The first few months were a struggle, not only from a communication standpoint, but there was, coming from a U.S. background and going to a mechanical engineering school, I felt I knew what I was doing. I go in and start designing these parts and get these feedback from my bosses that I was shocked by the level of detail that they were looking
for. Give us an example of what you mean by that.
Well, some of the first parts I did were door hinges, hood hinges, and handles. So things like, where do you put the bosses on the part? Are you optimizing it for the tool construction? Where is the parting line going to be? Is it in a place where somebody could feel it? Are you, strength of the part, those types of things. But it was especially that interface with the end customer that I hadn't been trained so much to think about. And, looking at some competitor cars a few months into the job and saying, oh, these guys aren't thinking about this, and it really shows in the end product, made me begin to appreciate the scrutiny I was getting and view it as an opportunity.
So you were looking at it purely from the point of, okay, I'm an engineer. I've got to design this to perform a function.
That's right.
And so whatever it takes to get the functionality, that's what matters, full stop.
That's
but
right.
They were saying, wait a minute.
There's so much more to it. And, I think especially at that time, 20 years ago, you really saw that in the products from Toyota and other Japanese companies. I think a lot of the competitors have caught up, but it is still something that I view as very important to what I do and to what we do at Toyota here in North America.
You mean the details and thinking through to the end customer.
Focusing on the details, exactly, yes.
So it's rather remarkable and I think encouraging for a lot of people who would be listening to this that, okay, you were designing hinges and now you're the chief engineer of the largest selling car in America.
Yeah.
For years running. I mean, how'd that happen?
And I think it's really important. It's, that's the way we start. We also spend time out working on the production line, learning what the production people go through.
Which is awesome. I think that's great.
It's the foundation that we want all of our engineers to have.
I've always heard that Toyota appoints a shusa, almost like a god in charge of each product. And the shusa, one of their duties is to keep what I call the big book of answers. Everything they've gone through, every problem, how it got solved, which suppliers were involved, blah, 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 blah. And once Toyota gets a design right, it takes like another act of God to get it changed.
Yeah.
So when you were doing door hinges and hood hinges and all that, did they ever come over and say, oh, very nice, Monty, but no need to do it. We solved that years ago.
Hmm. So there certainly are rules that are set in place to help us make sure we guarantee quality and we don't repeat past problems. There is also the strong emphasis on continuous improvement. And that's definitely rewarded. If you have an idea, it's reviewed, considered, and many times it does make its way into the product.
So is there anything in particular with the Camry that you're really proud of, like something you fought for and you're really glad it made it into the car?
Yes. So the styling you've seen... Mm-hmm. But it's the dynamic performance that we think will really surprise people. As we did the development and as we've shown it to some of our management, that's what surprised them. They thought, oh, we knew you were doing a lot. We knew you were going to improve the appearance, but I didn't know you were doing this. So it's the braking performance, the ride and handling, and the steering feel that we hope will surprise you when you drive it.
Talk a little bit about what drove you to do that, because, you know, Toyota executives used to brag, we make a lot of money on plain vanilla. Yeah. But now the company's really stepping up its styling, and to your point on this, it's vehicle dynamics as well.
Right. You know, the Avalon program that just came before us learned a lot, built a lot upon the K platform that we are sharing. And our engineers were able to take a lot of those ideas that were developed for the Avalon and bring them to the Camry. So you will see a lot of improvements that didn't take a whole lot of change that make a big impression overall. And there are synergies that we were able to bring in V performance, enhancing the overall comfort feel of the car, the stability that I talked about, stability in the braking, complementing the improved stability we're giving in the handling. So the synergies come together to, I think, really give us a much improved vehicle.
So you mentioned the Avalon, the new Avalon, and that's been a success by all measures, especially if we look at previous generations of the car. I mean, is that something that spurred you guys on, or had you already been thinking that you needed to do more with the Camry?
So certainly the things we learned as we developed the Avalon, and I was actually part of that team for a while, working with Chief Engineer Randy Stevens.
Who was on the show, what was it, a year or two ago, whenever the Avalon came out, right?
You know, all of us wanted to take some of those ideas to the Camry. So it was kind of a homegrown North American, let's put this, we know we can make it better, let's do it.
And you're in charge of the next generation Camry, right?
I'm in charge of life cycle management. I'm not going to talk about the future too far ahead.
But there probably will be a Camry.
There will probably always be another
Camry. I don't think that you'll be giving anything away with that. But so, you know, it's interesting that you'd think that if you're working with something for a long time, you become comfortable with it and that there really wouldn't be that impetus to make a change. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you introduced this car at the New York Auto Show, and I would argue that was probably the most significant thing there by far, that, you know, you guys basically said, you know, this is not a refresh. This is, you know, an all-new Camry.
Right.
And, you know, and as John said, that, you know, everybody's always, you know, had the knock on Toyota of its vanilla, its appliance, it's this, that, and the other thing. And I think that, you know, certainly with the Avalon now, with the styling of this car, that people are saying, whoa, wait a minute, you know, these guys are getting something. And so, you know, the guys at Kelty, Kevin Hunter, and the guys out in Newport Beach, and the guys at TTC here in Ann Arbor, you know, it seems that they're getting to add more.
Yes, absolutely.
So is there been like a rejuvenation of the culture in North America for Toyota?
Well, we've matured, I think, is the key point. And we're now able to hold our own and do these types of things that you're talking about.
Well, I think it's important, too. This is probably Toyota's arguably most important market, the U.S. is, certainly the most profitable one for the company. And here's the best-selling car, you know, in the market. Boy, it counts for a lot. But what I want to ask you about is, as you mentioned, you're chief engineer for North America Camry. Yeah. How do you interact with your other compadres in the rest of the world? And they go, ooh, look what Monty did. I want that, too. Or are you doing the same with theirs? How does that work in different regions?
Well, there are different body structures for the Camry in different regions. But the Australia, Toyota Australia group, did want to take what we were doing. And so we're working closely with Australia. We've had many engineers from Australia come here and help us build it. And so this version will be built both in Australia and here in the States.
But other aspects, you know, details or things like that, I'm sure some of the others are going to want to say, yep, I want that in my car.
Yes, absolutely. Some of the NV performance improvements, some of the ride and handling improvements they are doing in other regions as well, yes.
And do you get to see, well, of course, you get to see what they're doing, too. Are you looking for ideas with what your compatriots are doing?
Yeah, we definitely do. And we're taking some of their ideas. They've developed some special performance additions, and we're bringing some of those parts over for us.
Ooh, interesting.
So tell us a little something about what Toyota's footprint is in terms of engineering and developing vehicles in North America. What do you guys have?
Well, we have just about everything. We don't necessarily have every aspect of every component. You know, for example, in engines, we're focusing on V8. But we really have every division of the company represented here in North America now. Mm-hmm. You know, we design basically every aspect of the car. We have the capability now to do just about everything here in North America.
It's just a few select Lexus products, right, that are still
That's
Japan.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
So you have a full engineering group in Ann Arbor. There are hundreds and hundreds of people that are working out there.
We do. Absolutely.
You're going to be moving purchasing from Erlanger, Kentucky, up to the Toyota Technical Center, which is also a large campus rather than a building. I mean, it's
absolutely. And we're very excited about that. We think it will really help us improve the development of components with our suppliers, making sure that we're all in that under one roof together.
That's very interesting. Why would that change, or how will it change?
Well, today we're developing products in Michigan with some supplier personnel here. And then there are other suppliers that are focused on the purchasing group in Erlanger. So it can cause delays in development. And by having us all here together focused on all the same things, manufacturing improvements, performance improvements, and how to put those together in a single product, I think will improve our efficiency, our time to production, and overall cost of developing.
Oh, listen to that. Here's Toyota, the biggest, strongest, most profitable car company in the world, and it's about to get better.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty amazing.
And I think a key indicator of the strength in this market is that the Georgetown plant turned out its 10 millionth vehicle today.
Jeez, wow.
It was a Camry.
It was. How often do you travel to Japan?
Oh, it varies a lot.
Yeah.
In some phases, it's frequent, and right now we're focused on getting ready to produce this, so there's a lot more travel to TMMK. Mm. And we really do appreciate working with TMMK. Will James and team, they are very strong supporters of what we're doing. Without their support and their willingness to take on challenges, we really couldn't have done what we're doing in the new Camry. To achieve this level of styling improvement that we've done and that premium style that we've set out for, we had to challenge the production team to do some things that they don't typically like to do with the high-volume vehicles like a Camry.
What, deeper draws?
Exactly. Sharper corner radiuses, things that when you're making $40,000 a month is more difficult to do.
So the TMMK that he mentioned, for those that don't know, is Toyota Motor Manufacturing Kentucky, which is the Georgetown operations where the first Toyota plant in the United States, of which there are now several. But so the point being that you have the Kelty guys, the designers and the stylists, and they come up with this shape. You engineers figure out whether it's going to be able to do the function.
Right.
Then the manufacturing engineering people have to figure out if you can make the damn thing, and then the production engineers have to figure out if you can make it in volume.
That's right. And it was really a collaborative North American effort saying, we want to do this. We've heard the customers telling us they want more as far as the styling goes. How can we do that? And it was a strong effort on the production engineering side to achieve these things. We actually took the slogan of, let's break the rules. These rules for the 40,000 a month, you know, typically you want softer radiuses, those types of things. Let's break those. Let's see how far we can push the limits to achieve the styling.
Typically, up until now, Japanese companies operating here, let's say Toyota, Honda, Nissan, have pretty much taken structures from Japan and then,
right,
you know, homologized it, homologated it for the U.S. market. Do you see the day coming where maybe you would do a from-scratch vehicle? I know it's being done with the truck products, but I'm asking with passenger cars.
That's a difficult question. I don't know. We certainly see efficiencies in having standard platforms, just like I think most of the other automakers do, and I see that continuing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Avalon's a good example, though, of very much from the platform
from
up.
From here, right.
Yeah, that's right.
So in other words, having a platform that's shared around the world,
yes,
with variants on that. And I think that's, you know, to your point, that's basically what the traditional domestics have discovered that, gee whiz, it might make sense to have, oh, I don't know, one Focus everywhere, or, you know, one Fusion, and maybe we'll have a different name in Europe, but it'll be the same car. And you know, make modifications as required, rather than, okay, this is an American car, this is an Asian car, this is a European car. So just basically use the same.
Right, but taking that platform and doing a unique vehicle on it, actually we've done a few of those at TTC. The Venza's one, the Sienna, the Avalon. So we already...
Solara at one point, too.
Exactly.
Sure. Hey, look, we're getting some questions in here from the audience. I think it's time to get into the rapid-fire part of the show where we take audience questions. And, Ben, let it rip.
So, get rid of this here.
Okay, Rum and Coke wants to know, does Camry use a CVT? He says he just recently got a Corolla and didn't like it, but...
The hybrid uses a CVT.
Okay. What do you think about CVTs, though, for non-hybrid versions? They deliver terrific real-world fuel economy.
Really?
Listen,
I've driven the
Accord.
I agree, they do.
And I've driven the Altima. Yeah. And
I have to tell you, I personally do not like the sound that they make. I really like the sound of the ship going.
Yeah, yes. Right. Well, you can fake that now, right?
The Symposer put it in there, and you're all set to go. Yeah.
So maybe you guys don't need a CVT for cafe reasons just yet.
We don't think we do. We're very happy with our powertrain.
Oh, very interesting.
So there's no CVT that Toyota has?
Oh, we have
hybrid. Yeah, but I mean...
The Corolla.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of CVTs, except that, man, they deliver the fuel economy. So, anyway, here's another interesting question. You know, Chrysler, with their design, puts in little design elements that they don't tell anybody about. You got to go hunt for them yourself and find them. They call them Easter eggs because you got to go hunt for them. And here's the question again from Rum and Coke. Any Easter eggs on your car?
We'll let you wait until the car
So there are. Should we go searching or not?
Please.
Please go searching. and he wants to know, maybe a hidden Godzilla? That would be kind of cool. Let's see. Rural Juror wants to know, what plans exist to bring a Lexus assembly to the U.S.? I know that's not necessarily a question for you, but...
Yeah. Well, we've already come out with that.
Oh, have you?
TMMK has announced that they will be producing the ES in the future.
Oh, okay. I guess
the near future.
Yeah. And they've been building the RX in Canada for a number of years. That's been 10 years, maybe?
Something like that, yeah.
Let's see. What do you think about Toyota's move to the Great Republic of Texas?
I think it's really smart for the same reasons that we just talked about for bringing purchasing up here with engineering. Centralizing our leadership all in that one facility is going to streamline decision-making. It's absolutely the right decision. It's very smart.
Here, I'm going to throw this one to you guys because it's got nothing to do with Toyota or the Camry, and it's got to be... I haven't heard anything about this at all. Drew wants to know, can you guys shed some light on Automobile Magazine firing most of their staff and Gene Jennings?
So you didn't hear about this?
Yeah. No.
It was the late-breaking news today.
Yeah. Today?
Yeah.
Gene was here yesterday.
Yeah.
So
what the hell happened?
And they're moving from Ann Arbor to Royal Oak.
What?
And Todd Lasso, who was sitting in this seat last week, still working there.
Good.
So they didn't get rid of everyone.
Holy moly.
And there's the rumor about it becoming all digital and not putting ink on paper anymore. But
I had not heard this at all.
I was
stuck in traffic.
And it probably wasn't on the radio. But this gets back to this whole question of, you know, how many car magazines are there going to be, the interest that people have, you know, racing fanatics, car fanatics.
The thing I found most ironic was I first heard the news from Jalopnik, which I think says it all. I mean, the blogs have replaced books.
Yeah, that's right. You run to the blogs for your late breaking news. Right.
And I immediately got someone sent me a link to MLive, which is a digital only
Michigan
news source,
News source.
And which had a link to the Jalopnik story in it. But that's part of the thing. I mean, and like Christy knows, her magazine has gone all digital, and they're still doing very well, I think.
Yeah,
and,
we are.
So it's a whole changing landscape,
that's
for sure.
Holy moly, yeah, I hadn't heard anything about it, so that's a shock to me.
She gets to keep Gino's cars, though, right? I think that's...
Well, that's interesting, if true, because it's the same company that owns both Automobile and Gino's cars.
Right, Source Interlink, I think.
I think that's right.
Name of the company, yeah.
Well, wow. It's amazing that I got to come on my own show to learn what's going on.
Again, you were stuck in traffic. And doing the responsible thing of not looking at your phone. And,
right.
Hey, we got some phone calls here. Okay. Ben, let's bring one of those in.
Hi, guys and gal. This is Youngblood calling Cleveland, Ohio. I think you're over-evaluating the problem with racing. I think it comes down to something that's a lot simpler than what you're trying to pick out. All the people want to do is see readily recognized. They want to see a Camaro beating on a Mustang, beating on a Charger, beating on a Corvette, beating on a Challenger, just like in the 60s and 70s with the Trans Am series. That stuff was all based on production foundations. Then they could go from there, make a race car out of it. I mean, you could recognize what you're looking at. NASCAR nowadays, all of the cars look like modified picnic tables. They're nothing that's on the street. I mean,
I would agree with that, Youngblood. I think it makes a big difference. You know, the Indy cars, they're all the same chassis. You know, the engines are different. That's it. The graphics are different. You know, NASCAR, they're a little bit different now, but boy, if they stripped those decals off the noses, it would be hard to tell them apart. So I agree. I would love to see.
And there is a Camry in NASCAR, so let's not forget that.
That's exactly right. Okay, we've got another question here from Wright Knight, who wants to know, and you hinted at this, why not do a truly high-performance version of the Camry? He's talking 400 horsepower twin-turbo V6.
Yeah. Well, we'll save that for some other A's. But we are, I think we have other places that we can do that. But we are launching an XSE. Today we have LE, XLE, SE. There was a hole, and we're filling that now with an XSE. So to me, that's the favorite that I have driven.
And it's more performance-oriented?
It is, it is.
Can you give us any details?
So it has the V6, the larger wheels. The chassis is tuned to be more stable, more fun to drive, more precision in the steering. So it's not exactly what he's talking about, but I think it will definitely be a favorite of people who love cars and are looking for something fun to drive.
That's interesting. That's good to see a performance version of the Camry coming, or more performance-tuned kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Hey, Ben, we got another phone call here, too. Why don't we get into that?
Hi, it's Jonathan out in New Jersey. I was wondering, since you were talking about Chrysler Fiat's five-year plan, my question is the Mazda derivative Alpha Spider back on to the United States? If so, when is it due to arrive? Thank you very much. Always enjoy the show. Any aspects? Have a nice evening.
Yeah, thanks, Jonathan. Fiat was going to collaborate with Mazda, right? To do its own version of the Miata, the MX-5.
Right.
And then
I thought
they backed out of that.
I thought they backed out too. I thought Mazda was just going to be engineering it.
Right. I think.
Yeah, I don't cover Mazda anymore, so I'm not quite clear on that. But I hadn't heard they backed out.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Sorry. We think it's not going to happen.
Yeah. It's definitive maybe.
So Larry Johnson says, what are the differentiators between the 2014 and the 2014.5 Camry currently being marketed in my region, Texas? He says the 2014.5 model is being heavily advertised. I wonder why I'd want that model as opposed to the 2014.
All right. The The audio's been upgraded. I think you'll find that much more. It's easier to use. New features added, improved overall user experience. Also, we upgraded the body to meet the IIHS requirements for small overlap. So that vehicle achieves the top safety pick from IIHS. And with the 14.5 model year, we launched a hybrid SE. First time to have the SE styling, the sportier styling on a hybrid for Camry.
And so the car we've been talking about earlier will be a 2015 model.
That's right.
So that's the big change.
Yes.
So if somebody's wondering about 2014, 2014 and a half, 2015, this is the step change.
That's right.
This is a so arguably the 2014.5 would be a mid-cycle refresh.
Yes. That's right.
JM1NB says, in the design process, or let's call it the PD process, what percentage of time and money is spent designing for the customer versus for regulations versus just engineering and production? Do you ever break it down that way?
Sure. Overwhelmingly, it's for the customer. The regulations require certain things, but we can usually work those into what we're doing for marketability. So I don't know if I'd want to throw out any numbers, but I think the regulation side of it is small, maybe 10% or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. I would have expected it to be more. I guess you guys have accumulated a lot of knowledge and incorporated a lot of those things into the design along the way anyway.
You know, if you're redesigning all the exterior sheet metal, you can include some of these things in that job without a lot of extra development hours.
We've seen Ford talk about, not talk, they're going to make the F-150 very aluminum intensive. Mm. We see, you know, Jaguar, Land Rover, Audi going that way. What are your thoughts along the lines of aluminum?
Oh, fantastic. It's a little bit pricey, but definitely helps you achieve your mass targets and fuel economy.
Yeah, so is the 2015 Camry any lighter than the 14.5?
No, it's not. We've added several things to improve the performance, improve the NV, ride comfort, steering, handling, all that. And fortunately, in Toyota, we usually design majors with some margin for mass so that we can make changes in the minors. We can add technology or improvements as needed. So we took advantage of that fully with what we're doing.
So it's a little bit heavier, but I imagine there was no fuel economy penalty?
Absolutely not. You know, we kept within the emission test weights, ETW limits, and of course we kept within those to maintain fuel economy.
Were you able to do anything else to the car to improve fuel economy?
We modified the aerodynamics. The styling is like I said, has more swept plan view, more rounded overall. We improved and through that maintained the current fuel economy.
Mm-hmm. What else? What else should we ask about Toyota product development and the Camry in particular?
So if we take, okay, we assume that the consumer is the most important aspect, but from an engineer's point of view, going forward as you develop cars, and I'm not asking you to give any specifics about any future model plans or anything like that, but I mean, what are the challenges that you see that we're going to need to address going forward?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what we ask, right? Looking forward 10 years, 20 years, what do we need to be doing? Certainly a replacement for gasoline, we know everybody's looking at. You guys were talking about earlier with electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Toyota thinks fuel cells are going to be it.
So you guys are going introducing your hydrogen car next year.
Yes. Mass. How can we reduce mass? What technologies besides aluminum are there and should we be investing in? What future safety performances will there be and should we be planning for? The other is the automated car. You know, we're doing a lot in Ann Arbor with automated driving, pilotless vehicles. So those are all areas we are focused on and looking at. And I guess the other one is, how the North American market will change driving habits.
What do you see that might change in that regard? What does Toyota see?
I think a lot of it's been published, but you know, certainly more of this type of thing like you talked about with Google, where you go to a point, you use the car, you share the car, less personal ownership.
See, and I've talked to designers over the last few years and asked them the question that do you have to design, especially interiors, differently, knowing that this will be a car that, you know, the four of us are going to drive and we don't know each other, right? Unlike a car that a family drives or an individual drives, and so do you need to begin to think about new materials and new surfaces and so on, you know, easier to clean out and so on? And would that have an effect on how the vehicle is engineered, or is basically the platforms that we have sufficient to take care of things like that?
Absolutely. You know, I think we should. I'm not going to comment any further on that one, but absolutely we have to think about how to use what we predict will be happening and use that to change what we're doing in our development.
Mm-hmm. Maybe plexiglass partitions. Everybody will have their own little cube.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of change in this industry in the next 10 years. You know, up to now we've seen changes in the vehicles, technologically downsized engines, more gears, more lightweight materials, more electronics, connectivity. But when you start getting into car sharing or this vehicle-to-vehicle communication and start looking at the automobile as a transportation ecosystem, wow, that really starts to change how cars get used, how they get bought, how they get sold, and how they get used.
And if you had a Google car when you were stuck out in traffic, you'd have done the show from there.
Yeah, they're going to have to come up with a better styled car before I get in one of those things.
Come on, it's googly.
It is googly, right. Hey, it's probably a good time to wrap this up. But Monty, Kara, thanks so much for coming on and sharing some of your insights about the new Camry.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Christy, great having you, too. Yeah.
Thank you, John.
Real pleasure having you here. Very interesting comments on the BMW i8. We'll see where that all goes. And Gary, good seeing you again.
Good seeing you.
As always.
So, do it next week.
We'll do it again next week, you bet. And all you in the audience, you're welcome to come on back.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.